The name of Jim Ryan is a name that is not so readily recognized as it was 30 or 40 years ago. Jim Ryan was a runner, an Olympic runner. In fact, he was the first person who, as a high school student, was able to run the mile in less than 4 minutes. In the providence of God, I was at that meet, was able to see it take place in Compton, California. 3 minutes, 59 seconds. Now, that was at the end of his junior year in high school. He didn't just go out one day and decide that he was going to run the mile and do it under 4 minutes. And that it would take no work at all. In fact, as a freshman, his coach timed him in the mile 5 minutes and 31 seconds. But what Jim did in the meantime, you see, was that he worked at it. And he worked, and he worked, and he worked. I recall reading a book about Jim Ryan. It was perhaps one that he had written with a co-writer. And he described some of the workouts that he had done. Incredibly strenuous workouts. Nothing like what the track team that I was on did, either in high school or college. But he needed to do those kinds of workouts in order to be able to run at the end of his junior year of high school, to be able to run the mile in actually less than 4 minutes. And then later on in his life, shortly after that, to be able to break the world record for the mile run. Now, if you asked Jim what it was like doing those workouts, he probably would have said, well, it wasn't all that much fun. It was strenuous. But when you're dedicated to a cause like that, that's what it takes. And he was dedicated to doing that. But it also then produced the reward of enabling him to accomplish what he set out to do. Not just to break the 4 minute barrier as a high school student, but then also to be able to break the world record. Discipline has its rewards. Now, the writer of Hebrews reminds us that discipline for the time being is not joyful. But there is a joy that comes through that discipline as you come to meet the goal that God has given or that you have set for that discipline. And there are different kinds of discipline. There's discipline which you might require of yourself. Then there is discipline which other people might require of you, perhaps a business owner for whom you work. And so you discipline yourself in order to be able to carry on that work. Maybe he would have you go on, maybe that employer would have you go on to earn a greater degree that would be more useful, that make you more useful in the work that you're doing. But then there's also the discipline that God brings upon us. And it's not just the discipline in which he says, do this and don't do that. But then there's also the discipline on the events that he brings into our lives. And it's particularly this latter discipline that the writer of the book of Hebrews is setting before us when we come to Hebrews chapter 13. Many people might say, well, why do we have to be disciplined at all? Why does God have to discipline us at all? Doesn't that mean that he doesn't love us? Actually, it's quite the opposite. There are many people, though, even who call themselves Christian, who look at life as if somehow we are to be able to have the very best in life and to enjoy all the things of life. Otherwise, we don't have enough faith. On the way over here this morning, we just pulled onto Teaneck Road, and there was a man driving along in a Porsche convertible. What a beautiful day to be driving a convertible, but this was a Porsche. Just an immaculate car. And many people in the Christian church would say, well, that's what you should be driving as a Christian, because after all, shouldn't you have the best in life because you serve God? And so there are many people who say, you know, look, you should have the best of health and the greatest wealth. And then that brings us back to the announcement I made earlier about Pastor Ray Diamond passing away in the night. Why should he have to pass away? Is it because he committed some great sin? No, not at all. But we face these issues. There are others who say, well, as Christians, we should become completely holy so that we never sin. I remember a minister in the town we moved here from that believed that concerning himself, that he had reached the point where he no longer sinned. The passage that we're looking at here this morning is one that refutes both of those notions. That discipline is something that we are to be involved in, and we are to submit to God's discipline in order that we might conform more and more to His image. And so let's read, beginning with Hebrews chapter 12, the first verse, reading the first 13 verses of this chapter. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. And do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons, for what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in His holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet, so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. May God bless to us the reading of this portion of His Word, and may He indeed teach us from it as we consider it before Him together this morning. Why does God discipline us? Well, we're going to see a number of things that answer to that question. And the first is that He disciplines you because He loves you. Now, that's, as far as our culture is concerned, that is something that is counterintuitive. that God would discipline us because he loves us. After all, think of some of the things that have been going on in our society. One of the ways in which, at least in some schools, it has been said that you don't say no to students. You don't say they're wrong. So that if they say that 3 + 3 = 8, well, that's fine, Johnny. Go ahead. And so there becomes no absolute truth. And when Johnny adds up his deals or tries to balance his bank statement later on in life and still believes that 3 + 3 = 8, he's going to be upset with the banker because things aren't adding up properly. It's counterintuitive to our society, to much of our culture, to be able to say no to someone and to discipline someone and to say, you're wrong. But you see, they're substituting license for love. Probably the toughest teacher I ever had was Miss Bogart, the sixth grade teacher. She never married, and it was obvious. Not in the way that she dealt with us. You could not go out to recess until you had corrected every error on every paper that you had turned in. And there were some times that we sat in there for many, many recesses and just prayed for the time when she would have to be out in charge monitoring the outdoors so that then we could go out because she wouldn't be in there to monitor us. But it was good for us. It was good for us to have to correct our mistakes, to learn from them. You see, once we are left in sin, once we are left to think that there is no ultimate truth or absolute truth, life becomes much more difficult. Now, you might think it's difficult when things don't go the way you want them to go, when you're following the rules. But it becomes ultimately much more difficult when you don't follow the rules and aren't corrected for it. How often has it happened that someone does something wrong and refuses to own up to it for a while, only to find out that it makes things tougher down the road? Just yesterday, as I listened to the radio, they were saying, well, here's a man who obviously used performance-enhancing drugs. He was not elected to the All-Star Game to be played this week. But here are two others that were selected for the All-Star Game. How come they were selected and this other one who has put up a wonderful season was not selected? And the answer came back, they owned up to it. Whereas this other one sued everybody, including the Players Association. He only made things more difficult for himself. You see, life is ultimately more difficult when we remain in our sin, when we hold on to it instead of being disciplined to turn away from it. Not to receive discipline is to leave us with the expectation of destruction. Did you notice how the writer of Hebrews put it here? That if you are not disciplined, then you are illegitimate children. You are not true sons of your heavenly Father. You don't have the privileges of being his sons and daughters. And so it is that we find many times, particularly in the book of Proverbs, of what love it is to spare someone from the pit by discipline.
So, God disciplines you because he loves you. What's he want to bring out in us? Well, the first thing he wants to bring out in us is holiness. Or maybe we should put it a different way, that he wants to instill holiness in us. He wants that to be the state of our character. Because you see, holiness has to do with the sense of being, with what we are. It describes the state of the Christian's character. When you go back to Matthew chapter 5, or rather 15, you find Jesus dealing with some of his opponents there who are upset because his disciples haven't washed their hands before eating. And of course, he's not talking about when your mother tells you to go wash your hands before dinner in order to be sure that you get rid of the any germs that might be there, but rather this was a ceremonial washing. Something that God had not appointed for them in his word. And so here are these people who are very careful about the way they eat, as if somehow if they ate with unwashed hands, which would then be defiled hands, that somehow they would be corrupted. And Jesus says, don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body? But the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and these make a man unclean. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what make a man unclean, but eating with unwashed hands does not make him unclean. You see, Jesus is talking there about the heart and the state of the heart, which is to be holy. It's when there is that unholiness that loves all of these other things, that's where these sins come from. And so discipline is to shape the heart, to shape its character from which you act. And the way that he puts it here is that you are to share in God's discipline. Verse 10, our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines for us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. His holiness. Not our style of holiness. Oh, we all have our own ways of looking at what holiness is, and we find that throughout our society. We even find Christians establishing their own kind of holiness. I went to a Christian school that had all sorts of rules that we were to follow. Now, those rules were not holiness, but they looked like holiness. As far as the authorities were concerned. But what God's discipline does for us is it shapes our hearts so that we become holy. We are made to be holy. In Ephesians chapter 4, 24, holiness is one of the things that the Apostle Paul mentions as being a part of the character that we are to have. And how we have been changed from following the world to following Christ. You did not learn Christ in the way of the world, but rather, if indeed you have been taught in him, just as the truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lust of deceit. And there's some of the act of discipline. And then further discipline, that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind. And then further, that you put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. So it's the character that you become. It's the heart that is shaped according to the will of God. Does that mean you become sinless? Not until you reach heaven. Nevertheless, you are coming to love the things that God loves, the things that please Him, the things that honor Him. You are His image bearers. Now, there's something further that is produced. First of all, God disciplines us because He loves us. And He wants to make us to be holy. He wants the inner heart to be holy. But then from that heart then, as was indicated in the opposite of what Jesus was saying there, it's from the heart, remember, that come the evil thoughts and murders and adulteries and so forth. Now from that heart are to come righteous acts. So that as we read on here, no discipline seems pleasant but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Other translations have there the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And I think I prefer that latter way of describing it or translating it. Although this gives us both the concepts of peace and of righteousness, and we need both of those. The peaceful fruit that we are to have then is righteousness. It is the obedient actions that come from the heart that has been made holy. Now, you might wonder how righteousness can produce peace. After all, there's a lot that goes on in the world where righteousness is producing unrest. The baker that says, "I can't bake a cake for your homosexual wedding." The person in a land of persecution who says, "I must worship the Lord." Boy, there's a lot of unrest there, isn't there? It doesn't look to us like it would be peace, but that is the ultimate outcome when there is righteousness, that there would indeed be peace. After all, as the disciples said, we must obey God rather than men. They knew that by acting righteously according to God's standard, it would be much better for them, and they would have peace, even though for the time being, if they would neglect to speak in the name of Christ, they would have peace among the men, but they would have no peace in their hearts from God. Those who love darkness hate righteousness, and they hate the righteous. But peace and righteousness do belong together. In fact, we see that in one of the Psalms, in Psalm 85, that love and faithfulness meet together, righteousness and peace kiss each other. That's Psalm 85, verse 10. Peace and righteousness belong together. You have peace with God as you walk in righteousness. And that's a greater peace than you can have with the world when you are disobeying God. God disciplines you then to produce this peaceful fruit, righteousness. Righteousness that comes from a heart that is holy, that is focused on Him, that loves Him, that delights in Him. Well, that brings us then to the action that we're to be involved in. And you see that in verses 12 and 13. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. God's discipline is given to you so that you might be made strong. And so he looks at it here as a kind of a physical thing where you need to strengthen that elbow or that knee, Maybe it's weightlifting or some other activity that you might be involved in order to strengthen those joints. Obviously, he's not so concerned that we have strong bodies here as he is that we have lives that are focused upon God. Where are you weak then in your walk with the Lord? Think about that in regard to your own life. Where are you weak in your walk with the Lord? Where's the weakest joint? Do you understand what His grace is? Do you understand the gospel? Do you understand it in its fullness of what Christ has done? If so, if that's where a weak spot is, you need to study the gospel to understand who Jesus is and what He has done, what His work is for you, and how it affects you. Do you see particular sins in your life? You recognize how anger rises up so easily in your own heart. How can you deal with that? What does the Word of God have to say about that anger, and how can you put that into operation as you submit more and more to Jesus Christ to strengthen yourself against such things? You are to be strengthened by discipline. Just as an athlete does his work out on the track or on the field or in the gym, and just as a student does his homework and studies well, and just as someone trains to learn his craft well, perhaps as an apprentice, so it is that you and I are to be laboring in order to strengthen ourselves in each discipline, so that the weak members become strong. They will not become strong without discipline. Allowing yourself to do or to go in paths that are sinful, then you are using something that is weak in order to try to make it strong, but instead you're tempting it so that before it's ready for that. I used to think that when a team warmed up before a game, perhaps in baseball, that as they throw the ball around the infield, they should throw it as hard as they can because that's what they're going to have to deal with. And they said, no, ease up a bit so that you get used to doing the throwing, that you get used to catching it, and so forth. You don't make it too tough on yourself. One time, the Los Angeles Dodgers had their great left-hander, Sandy Koufax, throw batting practice years after he had retired. And someone came out to the mound and said, "We're going to have somebody else throw batting practice because they can't hit what you're throwing up there. It's too tough, and you're going to put everybody into a slump instead of being able to encourage them and strengthen them for their work." As we repetitively learn to do what is right, the more we will be able to strengthen the members that we have. Be encouraged by the cloud of witnesses that you see around you. Remember that cloud that's mentioned back in the first verse? Those people who have gone before, what have they done? They have had to deal with the same sorts of things that you had to deal with. And what did they do? They disciplined themselves. When Enoch got up in the morning, he went to be with his Lord. And he was with his Lord so much that one day they couldn't find him. He had been taken. When God commanded Abraham to go out and sacrifice his son Isaac, he rose early in the morning to do it. He didn't wait around and say, let me be strong. Let me somehow be strengthened. No, he got right to it. And so we could go through a number of these people of the Old Covenant and how they lived their lives in such a way as to say, I must be strong. I must discipline myself. I must receive the Lord's discipline to do, learn to do what is right. And so he says, make level paths for your feet. Make level paths for your feet. If you're having trouble with lust and you're taking a route to work that takes you by the adult bookstore, change your route to work. Do whatever it takes to get yourself that level path that will strengthen you, allow you to become stronger, and to turn away from sin to do what is right. Consider the discipline then among the level paths among the faithful, those who have gone before you, and learn to take those same kinds of paths. When God saves us, we are not finished products. We wish we were. It'd be a lot easier than having to go through all this discipline, but that's not the way that God deals with us. He disciplines us while we are here so that we might become more and more conformed to the image of His Son. And He does it because He loves us. And He loves us in His discipline so that we might be holy and righteous and enjoy the peace that He gives. Because there is joy in what He produces in us through discipline.